You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Thanks for joining us, Monday night edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. It is a packed one. The Nets lose back-to-back heartbreakers against the two top contenders in the Eastern Conference. I'm going to start off solo on this edition, talking about how the Nets blew a game that I feel like they should have won against the Toronto Raptors. And then I'm going to be joined by the one, the only lifelong fan, Joshua Bass, to break down his experience watching LeBron James in year 15 in person, capping off one of the best weeks of his career, and how that effort resulted in a close Nets defeat after a valiant effort. All right, so without further ado, let's get into it. Locked On Nets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. I am your host, Gavin Shaw. After 4 years covering the Phoenix Suns, I moved back to my native New York to bring you a unique, feels generous, and maybe kind of a brag, but I'll say it, a unique perspective on the Brooklyn Nets, along with my partner in crime, Josh Bass. But once again, I am starting off solo on this one. All right, so the Nets fall 116-112 up north in the great city of Toronto. Raptors move on to an astounding 54-19 record. God, they have killed it this year. The Brooklyn Nets drop to a disappointing 23-50. Nets are up by 13 with 16 minutes left in this one. And kind of like the last time they played the Raptors, only about 10 days before, they fell apart on the way to Toronto, winning their 11th consecutive game against Brooklyn. As DeMar DeRozan down the stretch for Toronto. And from a Nets perspective, I don't know. It's again, like all these games, like I'll be honest with you guys. You guys are smart basketball fans. Yeah, I'm sucking up a little bit. These games like really do start to blend together a little bit with the Nets competing against great teams, but then just falling apart. There was an interesting stat in the Cavs game where the Nets, actually following that one, they've lost 12 games where they've led or were tied going into the fourth quarter, which is the most in the Eastern Conference. And after that Cleveland game, might even be up there for most in the Western Conference. I gotta do a little bit more research on that one. But again, like it feels inevitable at a certain point. And I guess it's more so for me because I usually watch them on tape delay. But you just get the feeling the Nets are gonna blow it every single time. And this time, what ultimately killed them was it was I think it was like tied up at 100 with about 4 minutes left, and the Nets go 2.5 minutes only scoring 3 points, and that's it. DeRozan comes down a couple of times, hits a few tough shots. Lowry drills a 26-footer, and despite all that, the Nets still had a chance because Crabbe and Damari Carroll, who was really excellent in this game, is in his return to Toronto, both hit incredibly difficult threes to give the Nets a shot, and then Caris LeVert makes this great play to get a steal, but then essentially blows the Nets' opportunity to make this a game with the ball down three with just over 30 seconds left by committing a 5-second violation when he still had a timeout. So again, Caris LeVert, a guy who's hasn't been quite as good the last two games, but we were saying has been excellent of late, makes a youthful mistake. You can forgive him, but it does hurt. I don't know. I don't know about you guys, but I feel like I want the Nets to get one special win, like one win over the Raptors, one win over the Cavs, like something to build a little bit of momentum going into the offseason. I know in like an 82 game schedule in a league that I know it doesn't always feel like it, but does have quite a bit of parity, you can't read too much into any single game. But I don't know. I just think it would be cool. And the tough thing is with Toronto and Cleveland gone, that opportunity to get that signature win is essentially over. I mean, there are only two games left against upper echelon opponents are at Philly Tuesday, April 3rd, which would be a big win, especially with how Philly's been playing like one of the best teams in the NBA for the last month or so. But I mean, that's still obviously a young team, so it doesn't really have quite the same ring to it that Cleveland or Toronto does. And then at Boston, final game of the season for Brooklyn. I don't know. I'm not really feeling that one either. So in that sense, tough that the Nets lost these two games. If you want to go kind of note by note, a couple interesting things. I like the way the Nets started on offense in this one. They were really confident and aggressive, and I think D'Lo really set the tone for that with his ball movement. I think he had like 5 assists in the first like 8 or 9 minutes of this one, and he was just so active and energetic, which was really inspiring. And I know, and he ended up getting his first career triple double in this one, and the first triple double a Nets player has had since 2011. I think it was Terrence Williams who got it in a double overtime game. D'Lo finishing this one, 18 points, 13 assists, 11 rebounds. Great stat line, marred by the fact that he was just 8 of 21 from the field, 0 of 4 from 3, 2 of 5 from the charity stripe, though. I know Kenny Atkinson said after the game he loved D'Lo's process and shot selection, and that he only took one bad shot the whole game, which is obviously an improvement of what we've seen at large from D'Angelo Russell, but I don't know. I mean, obviously he has to shoot the ball better. Like, the bottom line is, like, it's not like the bad shooting night was an anomaly. It's been the story all year for him, and frankly his entire career. So that's something that's going to have to change rapidly to affect D'Lo's career trajectory. The other big issue I have with D'Angelo Russell, maybe I'll spend some more time with Josh on this, because it's obvious the Cavs picked up on the same on this fact just as well as the Toronto Raptors did. It's that I can't imagine there are too many pick-and-roll defenders worse in the NBA than D'Angelo Russell. I mentioned earlier in the year that he just dies on picks, and now, like, recently, like, he's been just going over them, and that's almost worse than dying on picks, because his body doesn't even, like, inhibit the roller, the guy setting the screen, from getting into the lane. Because now he just goes over, and then he's out of the play. Like, I don't know, like, what he thinks is going to happen when he jumps over the screen. Like, obviously the point guard's going to be gone, the guy rolling to the rim is going to be gone, and he just puts his teammate in an impossible position where he has to guard two defenders, both of whom have a lot more momentum than he does. And, like, to me, like, that's, it usually results in an automatic 2 points, and it happened in the Raptors game, it happened in the Cavs game, but if it doesn't result in the automatic two, like, if the Nets, like, somehow get help over in time, which is rare, because it's a challenging thing to do if you just give two NBA players an open lane. It's going to kick off a sequence that's going to end in an open three, so it could potentially be even worse. So I think that's like the single most destructive thing I've seen about the Nets defense this year in terms of their efforts to be good on that end of the floor. It's D'Angelo Russell either dying on screens or going over them, and it's so frustrating to me. And I'm not really one to complain about Kenny Atkinson quite as much as Josh's, and that might be because Josh is potentially more knowledgeable about basketball than me. I would never say that with him on the air, but he really does a great job breaking down the game. Nobody tell him I said that. I don't get how Atkinson hasn't switched up his strategy on it, because you figure if Russell just ducks under the screen, like, I don't know, maybe at this point his process is, I'd rather give up an open two than an open three. But you just feel like I'd rather a point guard take a jumper with D'Lo getting a soft contest on it than LeBron or whoever the Raptors had rolling to the rim getting dunk after dunk after dunk. That's as far as I'll go. And I think it really hurt them against Toronto. Cleveland did flat out lost them the game, because they just couldn't handle it down the stretch. And I don't know if it was Larry Drew or LeBron calling those plays at the end of the game, but they knew every single time they put D'Lo in a pick and roll, they were gonna get a bucket. It was that simple. So D'Lo, a really mixed bag. There were certainly some highs and a lot of lows in this one. Caris LeVert's jumper, even though I don't think he finished that well, but he hit his first three, and Sarah Kustak pointed out that he had made 50% of his threes over the last 9 games. I know he didn't shoot well the last two, but just looking at it from like a slightly bigger sample size, his jumper just looks so good. When he's confident and he gets into some kind of rhythm, he just lofts it up there and falls down. Like, and I don't know how sustainable it is, because you get his follow through never looks that clean to me, but it goes in, it looks really, really, really good. All right, final thoughts on this one. Okay, the best, my favorite part of this game, and I know it probably should have been when the Nets were making a run and were up and looked really good, but my favorite part of this game was when the Raptors, specifically Kyle Lowry, stopped play to point out to the officials that the rim was imbalanced. It was slanted one way, and I've never seen that happen in an NBA or college game before. Like, I've seen guys dunk and like mess up the rim, but I've never seen a player call for time. And apparently the procedure on that is someone from the arena comes out, they bring out this big ladder, they have this little piece of machinery that I probably could have looked up what it is, but I didn't. And it measures whether or not the rim is balanced, though the numbers on it seem totally, not correlated with how the rim was looking, because it kept going up, then down, up, then down. Maybe that was just saying it was balanced one way or another, but it didn't seem right. And the craziest part was they finally get it balanced, and then Pascal Siakam, Toronto's second-year big, he just jumps up and hangs on the rim after they spend like 8 minutes getting this thing in working order again. And Ryan Rucco and Sarah Kustak both saying that's kind of weird. And apparently an official comes over to them and says they told Pascal to do that. So apparently Pascal Siakam inherently knows the perfect balance of a rim. I thought that kind of weirdness was perfect for a game in Canada. And again, continuing with tradition in Canada, the Nets lost this one. Shout out to Damari Carroll. Great game in his return to Canada, 14 points, 3 rebounds, 2 blocks, and a massive 3. One of the few Nets that was a net positive in this game, plus 6. First time on the floor, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson did a great job attacking in isolation, a lot of bully ball. And again, I really like how he's been playing. He's still been mixing in the improved jumper, but I continue to think his aggressiveness going to the rim is really, really nice to see and more in line with what we've seen from him in the past, and he's found a better balance between those two aspects of his offensive game, and it does have me really excited to see what he's going to do offensively next season when he can kind of boil this down into one complete offensive player. Alan Crabb shooting the ball spectacularly, 5 of 8 from 3, 6 of 10 from the field. Awesome. The bench contributing, Dante Cunningham, 10 points. I think the majority of those came in the first quarter. Joe Harris, solid game before his career high. But we'll get into that with Josh. He is coming on next to talk Cavs after we take a quick break. You are listening to Locked On Nets. Attention, cancer victims. If you or a loved one lived, worked, or visited Lower Manhattan in the months after the 9/11 attacks and have been diagnosed with cancer, federal benefits and health care may be available. Attorney Eddie Markowitz has helped many families recover substantial benefits from the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund. The James Zadroga Health and Compensation Act has been extended, but time is limited. Attorney Markowitz is proud to serve as counsel to the Zadroga family. Let him help you too. These benefits are not just for rescue workers, but to anyone who qualifies. The fund covers many cancers, including prostate, skin, lung, and breast. Please call 1-800-LAW-HELP. That's 1-800-LAW-HELP to see if you qualify. Welcome back into the Locked On Nets podcast. We just finished up talking about the Nets' heartbreaking loss against the Toronto Raptors, and now we are going to talk about their heartbreaking loss to the other best team in the Eastern Conference, and I'm joined by a familiar voice. The Joshua Bass was in attendance to watch LeBron cap off maybe one of the best weeks of his career in year 15. Josh, you went with a millionaire high school tutor and a friend of yours. Really, really exciting stuff, and you got to see LeBron.
Yeah, no, it was a treat all around, and getting to see the king is obviously a special moment. Only the second time I've seen him live, but he put on a show.
Yeah, what was it? 37 points, 10 rebounds, 8 assists, 14 of 19. Crazy. Yeah, just insane. And then he didn't hit a 3 all game, and then hits like a 30-footer to end it. And like that got me thinking, because I've tried to watch the Cavs quite a bit this year. I don't remember him, like, missing a shot in a clutch situation this year. It feels like he's, like you know how, like, Kobe, like, always gets, like, the hype for being, like, the closer, and, like, LeBron, like, and it's, like, just a narrative from early in his career that survives among idiots on the internet. But, like, he's kind of gotten, like, the rep for, like, oh, he, like, passes it in big situations, and he just tries to make the right basketball play, as if that's a bad thing. But I would honestly venture to say, like, he's made more shots in the final 90 seconds of games this year, or like close to it, than Kobe made in any season of his career, and probably close to the total number Kobe made in his career. People don't realize Kobe shot like 20% in clutch situations for his career.
Yeah, I mean, LeBron's approaching Joe Johnson status at this point.
I wouldn't go that far, but he's certainly been good. All right, so for Micah Adams, good. You know, before I even get into like the stats part of this, like what was it? You said it was amazing, but like what was it? You had like pretty good seats for the game. Like what was it like just watching him physically? Obviously, he had that like insane dunk at I think it was at the very end of the first quarter. Like just what was the experience like?
Yeah, I mean that dunk really got the crowd going, and every time he did anything, the crowd was just on its feet. Unfortunately, 80% at the Cavs fans, mm-hmm. which is a little disheartening to be outnumbered in your own building, but. I mean, the energy was just palpable. He got off the bench in the fourth quarter with about 8 minutes left to check in, and there was just a roar from the crowd. And anytime he had the ball, especially in transition, dribbling up the court, you could just feel the sense that everyone was ready to just explode if he just dunked on someone or made a great pass. And he had some nice plays, finished a couple alley-oops, and really put on a great game for the fans because he didn't really have a ton of help, but he carried the Cavs to that win by himself, basically.
Yeah, I think in some ways that's the biggest testament to – LeBron James' greatness. I remember I was recently rereading Bill Simmons' Book of Basketball, and this was 4 years ago. Like, or no, actually, I'm sorry. It was like eight or nine years ago. It was like 2008 or nine. And it was right after the decision was published. So probably 09 or 10. And Simmons in the book talks about how like he just goes to these Clippers games with guys that have been going there for 20 or 30 years, and just the way the crowd reacts to LeBron. He made the point that, and he just talking to people who have been going to games for 30 years, like people across the league in different arenas, no player has generated the kind of reaction LeBron has generated, like other than Michael Jordan, at least in modern memory. Like maybe Bird and Magic were doing it, and now I think Steph has a little bit of that. But it is incredible, like with a team like the Nets that are like essentially irrelevant at this point, and like we've both been to a few games at Barclays this year. Don't exactly draw ruckus crowds. They like LeBron just totally changes that dynamic. Josh, you can speak to this better than I can because you were just in it. But it sounds almost like you were like at like maybe not a finals game, but like a big playoff game, and like LeBron just by his sheer presence like creates that atmosphere.
Yeah, a playoff game or even like a dunk contest where everyone's just there for one specific thing, and there's all this ancillary stuff going on, like a 3-point shootout. And a skill challenge, and that's kind of the game going around LeBron. Everyone's there to see the main event.
All right, so LeBron is incredible. We told you the stat line. Hits the game-winning shot. Capped off a week that ESPN's Micah Adams, a stat guy who I really like, described as the most prolific offensive week of LeBron's career. He scored or assisted on 63.3 points per game for the week. That was the most he's ever done in a single week of his career in the 357th week of his career. And he did that while shooting 63% from the floor and leading the Cavs to a 4-0 record. The numbers, just astounding. I guess we said pretty much everything we could say on LeBron. He was incredible. Josh, you also got to witness the Joe Harris show. 11 of 14 from the field, 6-7 from three, 30 points, 7 rebounds in just 27 minutes. What was that like? Obviously, maybe not quite LeBron, but
that was
pretty
more
cool.
Fun than LeBron.
Really? Okay.
I was having the time of my life.
Yeah.
I could not believe it. Just going insane every time he scored. I actually need to go back and watch the highlights from his 30-point outburst because it was. I'm sure it was even more ridiculous to watch on TV. But first quarter, he's just draining threes. And then second and third quarter, he's really taking it to the basket well. And I think there was a stat saying that was top 5 or top 10 in the league in percentage on drives.
Yeah, he's third in the league.
Strong, good finisher around the basket. And I was like tormenting these Cavs fans around me saying, I remember when you guys had Joe Harris. And then they said, oh, we had him? And I said, yeah. Bandwagon.
Yeah, no, and it's interesting. He's like, he's a piece that would have been like a really good fit. Like obviously, like I think it was after he left that they ended up acquiring Kyle Korver. So they filled that role pretty well. But Harris on this year's Cavs. Yeah, I don't know. He just would have been like just such a good fit on this Cavs team. And they have so many guys who are. I mean, I guess like someone like Rodney Hood is a little bit more diverse in his game. But I think you make a good point. Like Harris's off the dribble ability, like especially like if he was playing with LeBron and the floor was totally open, like it would be really interesting to watch. And I've said that all year. It would be interesting to watch him on a good team. Like I was saying, like I really thought like he, especially after Roberson went down, like he could have changed OKC season. And like if you just plugged him in for Melo, like they would be a pretty significantly better team, which sounds, which like if someone had said that to me like preseason, like I would have called them insane, but it feels like that's true. And
I think the thing with Joe Harris, why that point makes sense is because he's never going to have a game where he goes 2 of 14 from the field.
Yeah.
If he's not feeling it, he's not going to shoot every time. And a guy like a Melo or a guy like a Rodney Hood is just gunning out there with no confidence, and he can either go 9 of 12 from the field or he can go 3 of 14. And Joe Harris, he's not going to be taking more than 4 or 5 shots unless he's really hitting a lot.
Yeah, what they really emphasized on the broadcast, and I agreed with this point, was just his competitive spirit in this game. And I don't want this to turn into the Joe Harris show. Like we say enough nice stuff about him, but like it was really cool. Like you were mentioning him attacking the basket. He had one play where LeBron was running out on him to stop a three, and Harris like got like a step on him, and you felt like LeBron was just going to recover and like destroy him, and then Harris like kind of pump fakes his way like by LeBron. LeBron gets taken out of the play. Larry Nance is still at the rim, but he has this like really nice finish inside, and like had another possession where he got 2 consecutive offensive rebounds, and like one of the Nets, like I'm sure you remember, like it was one of the Nets like biggest possessions of the fourth quarter, and it was just cool to see that fight for him, and like, and I thought like that embodied the effort from the team collectively. Like it seemed like with a couple of exceptions, like they were playing really, really hard in this one, and it was similar to that Toronto game where you just got the feeling like they wanted to win one of these to have something to reflect on going into the offseason. I thought coming into these two, it was kind of important that they won one or at least were competitive in both, and like I know the Nets have said time and time again, like no moral victories at this point in the season, and that's a fair point. Like I'm not super excited about these two games, but it was cool to see that fight is still there and to see them compete.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like earlier in the season, I would have been upset that they blew both these games, and I was just so numb to everything after the loss. Like, I obviously, when they're up like 5 or 6 early in the fourth quarter, I still expected them to lose. And then when they finally lost the lead, I said, okay, this is how things go. And when they ended up being down 5 or 6 at the end of the game, I said, yeah, this sounds about right.
Yeah.
There was no kind of like, oh, we could have done this to be better and blah, blah, blah. It's kind of what you expect from this team after 73 games.
Well, Josh, what were your, because I mean, I haven't seen them in person in a while. Like, did you have like any other takeaways from a Nets perspective that kind of differed from what you get watching on TV? Because I always feel like in person, you notice like little subtleties that you just kind of miss watching from your couch.
Yeah, I think that the ball movement was pretty good. Obviously, D'Angelo Russell struggled in that a little bit. But one thing I noticed is that a lot of guys in the Nets were making the extra pass, except Damari Carroll. Like, every time he got the ball, I feel like we've kind of touched on this a little bit this year, but it might be taboo to say every time he touched the ball, the possession ended with him. So there would be a great sequence of passes, and then he'd dribble in for a contested floater, and then I'm just kind of sitting there like, why? And then all the people around me who don't understand basketball as much are just like screaming, like, look how many rebounds LeBron has. But yeah. I feel like I understand the nuances of the game more than a casual fan, so it pains me to sit there with the other 20,000 of them, and they're not appreciating the pick and roll coverage that we're seeing.
Yeah, no, you're a real basketball supremacist. I remember we were watching the Final Four game, Kansas Duke, over at your place on Sunday night, and your dad was describing you as, quote, a basketball genius from an early age, and I think he was saying you finished like 4th in like his work like NCAA tournament pool when you were like 10 or 11.
That's part of my resume.
Yeah, no, I will. No, I wanted to like throw out there that like I think it's like it's kind of random, and like there are like idiots across the country that consistently do better than ESPN's quote unquote experts. But I didn't want to. But Barry seemed really proud of you, so I didn't want to knock him down.
They locked Joe Lenardi up in that cage for 11 months out of the year. People are better than him.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, that's a fair point. All right, we're gonna take a break, and then we will come back and finish up breaking down the Nets Cavs super game. And we're back on the Locked On Nets podcast. The Cleveland Cavaliers knocking off the Brooklyn Nets 121-114. LeBron James responsible for the dagger. From a positive perspective in this one, I like the way for the second game in a row how Spencer Dinwiddie played. We both noticed a downtick in his play specifically through March and the end of February. And it culminated in him going to the bench and D'Angelo Russell starting next to Allen Crabbe, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, and Damari Carroll. And it seemed like that really crushed Dinwiddie's spirit, and he wasn't playing with the same energy and, more importantly, confidence that he was early in the season. And perhaps he's just shooting the ball better again, but it's nice to see him have a little bit of that swagger back as we finish up this season.
Yeah, he's definitely experiencing a bit of a Luka downtick, as you can say.
Clever.
But I think that he had some tough threes off the dribble this game. Did a good job of getting to the basket and beating guys like a Tristan Thompson or even like a Kevin Love off the dribble. And those were plays that D'Angelo Russell wasn't really making. So I think Dinwiddie added a nice dimension for the offense. I think it's tough, honestly, because when Rondae Hollis-Jefferson and Jared Allen are playing together, there's no space for anyone to work. So there were times when LeVert had a mismatch against like Larry Nance or Kevin Love. He really just couldn't beat him off the dribble because there's no space. There's not a lot of shooters on the floor. And that's when I can empathize with Kenny Atkinson for being so obsessed with his dumb little system. But yeah, no, Dinwiddie, I thought, was good. He added a nice spark. He's had some good games against the Cavs this year. It wasn't remarkable by any sense, only 2 assists, but 16 points, 5-11 shooting from the field. I thought the shots he created were all good looks. He wasn't really bogging down the offense. He kept things moving. And then when they needed him to score and create a decent look, he was able to do it. So encouraging to see him have some momentum. Hopefully he can carry that over for the rest of the season, because he's a guy that I think Nets fans have really taken a liking to at the start of the year. Now might be some backlash just with him trying to do all this heroics at the end of games, and now people are saying D'Lo needs to be the guy regardless. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think it should be more merit-based, but good to see Dinwiddie get back on track. And he's just a guy that I really hope to net for a long time, because he's such a likable and intelligent dude.
Yeah, I'm interested to see where this ends up next season. I know this is something we've touched on in the past, but I don't think we've talked about it in a couple of weeks. So I'm okay culminating this episode in a mini discussion about it. And that's who's going to start next season. I know you're of the opinion, or at least were in the past, that Jeremy Lin's not really in the running for that spot. And I'm not so sure. Like, I could see him as part of a two-guard lineup, depending on where they decide to go. Maybe him and Dinwiddie, maybe him and Russell. But it's going to be interesting, because I still feel like Dinwiddie is the better player than D'Angelo Russell, and like both of them have a lot of games where they don't shoot the basketball well, and I feel like when that's happening, Dinwiddie is able to contribute more than Russell is and isn't as destructive of a presence on defense as Russell is, and I think that combination would earn him the starting spot. And like I'm not arguing with them starting Russell now. Like I think they should do it. Like they feel like he's the future of their franchise, and they might be right. They have more knowledge than we do on it, and there are special elements of Russell's game that could lead you down that train of thought. So I don't necessarily have an issue with them going with Russell in this meaningless final portion of a season. But next year, fresh start, presumably they're going to want to make a playoff push. You want to put your best possible group out there. I would make the case that barring anything dramatic this offseason, you could argue Russell's younger, he has more room to improve. Maybe that happens. I think for me, Dinwiddie should be the guy. But I'm interested to hear your thoughts on that, Josh.
I mean, parts of Russell's game that everyone always talks about. He's a horrible, inefficient scorer. Barely passes the ball. I know he can make a highlight pass or two every game or so, but like, what's that really doing for you in terms of wins and losses?
I don't know. I mean, I think we disagree on the functionality of his passing, because I think at times he is like legitimately a really good passer, and he does create buckets for guys that, or at least on a team that doesn't have a lot of individual creators and isn't really all that talented offensively. So I think he does have value, and like you could argue that's canceled out by the bad turnovers and the bad shots, and he needs to be more consistent with it. Like this game, he only had one assist. Like he's not a guy who does it night to night to night. But I don't know. I think now, and I think down the road, like his passing is could be a big deal for this team.
I don't know. I think that if you're the third year and you really haven't shown any improvement in that sense, like there's something wrong. And he definitely every like maybe twice a game can create a bucket out of nothing for his teammates by throwing an insane pass. But if the other 90% of the time you're just standing at the top of the key dribbling aimlessly until there's 6 or 7 on the shot clock, then you're doing more harm than you're creating value. I think Dinwiddie is not going to make this spectacular play, but he does a good job of keeping the ball moving. He's a good passer, not great, but he has pretty good vision. He's a willing passer, more importantly, much more willing than D'Angelo Russell is. And I think that's creating a lot of value for his teammates. And then even though Spencer Dinwiddie's gone through such a huge shooting slump in the second half, still has a higher true shooting percentage than D'Angelo Russell. Russell's at 51% true shooting for the year, absolutely garbage. 31% usage rate. I mean, he takes a ton of shots without scoring efficiently and without getting a lot of assists. So I'm not really sure how he's helping the team. And as you mentioned, I think actually we were talking about this earlier, his defense on pick and roll, he kind of gets out of the way. I'm not sure if that's on purpose or not, but it's an interesting decision nonetheless.
Yeah, you just see Atkinson scream from the bench, "Avoid, avoid!" And he just dives down. He just goes.
Pamplona doing the ball.
Yeah. He just dives on the floor, hands overhead every time there's a pick and roll that he's going to be involved in. Yeah. So I guess we're on the same page, even though I think you are continue to be like a little bit more down on D'Lo than I am, though. I'm pretty negative at this point too. So it's really. It's just a matter of degrees. I think to me the biggest thing, like the biggest priority for the Nets this offseason, outside of finding a way to get more young talent, which should always be priority number one, is adding a lot more pace to their offense. And I don't necessarily mean running in transition, but just taking shots early in the shot clock. And you nailed it. That's way more of an issue when D'Angelo Russell's in the game. Just finding a way to get him going and playing with pace, and whether that's constantly running him through pick and rolls or just getting him moving off the ball and catching the ball on the run. It's something we see Joe Harris do a lot. It's something we see Alan Crabb do a lot. And I know that's a tough ask of your point guard, but to me, that's the element that would make the biggest difference for this team. And maybe that just comes down to adding more quality depth. And it's similar to the Raptors, where a few years down the road, they'll be able to do something like that. But to me, that would be the biggest way to make D'Lo a more consistent offensive player. And I think Dinwiddie can occasionally get into slumps too, where he just waits for the offense to start and goes one-on-one. But I don't know. I think that would really help both guys. And I think we saw in the first half of that Raptors game, Josh, D'Lo was really effective in the first quarter, and it's because he was playing fast and making quick decisions.
Yeah, exactly. When he's going around a pick and roll and really doing either making a pocket pass or going all the way to the rim, he's good. When he's trying to get the guy on his back hip, and now he's like trying to take some weird floater that he always does, that's when he's bad. So you want more good D'Lo, less bad D'Lo, and then I'll be happier.
All right, great way to conclude the podcast, Josh. I know you're busy with work. Thanks so much for jumping on with me. And that'll wrap up this edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. We will be back later this week to talk you through the Nets' final 9 games or so. Pretty sad. The season's almost ending. Also, last second shout out to Ryan Rucco, friend of the pod, calling his final Nets game this year. Presumably, a lot of you are also Yankees fans. So you should enjoy him this summer on those broadcasts because he's going to be great and the team should be great.
Well, last year, Rucco was doing the call. That Yankees Tigers insane brawl. So if we get anything like the excitement last year for some of Rucco's calls, then we're in for a good season.
Yeah, there should. If nothing else, there should be a couple good home run calls this year between Aaron Judge and the newly dubbed as of 4 years ago or so, Giancarlo Stanton. All right, for Josh, I'm Gavin. Thanks for tuning in. Go Nets. Go Yankees. Peace out.